one, but of course there's a whole three-dimensional network of these things. We have a tangent vector on each one of those two d6 that I'm calling u. And you know, and then we went through this construction of drawing cross curves and rigidly, you know, drawing them on top of each other to define a notion of a deviation vector between neighboring two d6. So being, you know, working in differential geometry on the curved manifold, we have to be a little bit careful of how we, you know, define these things. And the correct way of approaching the problem is to, you know, always think of deviation vector, or any other vector for that matter, as being tangent to a curve. So we have the cross curves that I will draw here, and those give us this notion of deviation vector. We worked out that the deviation vector was everywhere orthogonal to the reference geodesic. So all of those equations that I'll be writing down are written on the reference geodesic. So we have a vector which is orthogonal. And if I define the direction of u, or the direction of the time like geodesics as being the time direction, then everything that's orthogonal to that is a spatial direction. And, you know, I'll use the words that the deviation vector is a spatial vector. Another word that I'll use is transverse. So the deviation vectors really define the transverse directions to the congruence. Oh, so you came here today.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we have that. And then the construction also gave us the equation that says that the derivative of the deviation vector along the congruence, or along the reference to d6, is the same thing as the derivative of the velocity field in the direction of the transverse vector. And this is a quantity that we called B alpha beta. And in just a second, I'll write down the decomposition of B in terms of its irreducible thesis. But before I do that, I just want to, you know, call attention to the interpretation of that quantity, because here we're talking about the derivative of the deviation vector in the direction of u. And that, you know, physically interpreted is the relative velocity of the two geodesics. It's the rate of change of the deviation vector. And in physical terms or elementary terms, we can call that the transverse velocity of the congruence. So it's really the relative velocity of this geodesic relative to that. And what we have, therefore, is an equation for the transverse velocity in terms of velocity gradient field. And, you know, as you remember, we had direct analogy between this equation and the one that applies in a simple fluid context. We worked out last time the fact that this tensor is purely transverse in the sense that it has no components along u. So that's something that we worked out before. And, you know, and therefore, the quantity guarantees that this vector, the transverse velocity, is indeed a transverse vector. So it's, you know, it only has spatial components. It does not have a time component. So I want to call attention to the fact that in this case, the deviation vector is purely transverse, and the transverse velocity also, well, the name implies it, the transverse velocity is also purely transverse vector. And I want to make sure you see that, because when we move over to the case of null geodesics probably this afternoon, we'll see that those features are a little bit harder to achieve in the null case. We're going to have to work hard at in null case, but in time-like case, they come out automatically. So we have the notion that the contraction of B along U in either direction is zero. So B is purely transverse. That makes the relative velocity, I can call it that, also purely transverse. Okay, and final thing, well, the other thing that we did was to decompose that tensor into irreducible pieces. And we had a trace part, we had a symmetric trace-free part, and we had an anti-symmetric part. And here we find all sorts of things. We find H as something which is, well, I'll say a few more things about it, but it essentially acts as a transverse, a projecting operator onto the transverse space. That quantity is purely orthogonal to U. I'll just come back to that in a second. So we've defined this. Theta was defined to be the trace of B, and that turns out to be equal to the divergence of the velocity vector field. Sigma, while is defined to be the symmetric part of B, which I indicate with round brackets, the standard notation for symmetrization of indices, but I have to remove the trace piece because it's symmetric and trace free. So that's the definition for sigma, and the definition for omega is that we isolate the antisymmetric part of B, and this is the standard notation. Square brackets around indices means that you've antisymmetrized the indices. So this is just our decomposition into irreducible pieces. And what I meant to say about H alpha beta is that, well, it's a notion of, it gives us a projection onto the transverse space. What I mean by that is simply that, like B, H has zero components along the u direction. Unlike B, H is symmetric, and if you project, if you take if you take the projection with U, you get U back for metric, but here you get minus U using the normalization condition on U, which means that this thing, is defined purely in transverse directions, and it has no component along time. And I said something about this acting as a projection operator. You can check that as any projection operator, if you act on it twice, with it twice, it's like acting with it only once. So two actions is like one action. So the mathematical expression of this is that if you multiply H with itself, you get back H. So once you've projected once, you don't need to do it again. And that just follows from doing the straightforward manipulation. You just multiply them. There are lots of U terms that will cancel out, and you just, you just do it, and that's what you find. And another, property that is important is the fact that the trace of H is 3, because the trace of the metric itself is 4, but the trace of that guy is minus 1 because of the usual normalization condition on U. So that makes, the interpretation of H then becomes something like, a spatial metric in the transverse space orthogonal to the reference to these. Okay, so that's, basically the geometric construction. And then one thing that we said last time was that with that Frobenius theorem business, which is to say that if on top of all, on top of the requirement that we made that the congruence be geodesic, if we also demand that it be hypersurface orthogonal, then and the meaning of that is simply that the vector u should be always perpendicular or normal to a bunch of hypersurfaces that are stacked on top of each other. If we have that on top, then it must be true that the rotation tensor vanishes. And I gave you a partial proof of that last time. So omega, which is the rotation tensor, vanishes if and only if the congruence is hypersurface orthogonal. And just to remind you, this is the expansion of the congruence. Theta is the expansion rate of the congruence, and we saw this as an interpretation in terms of the fractional rate of change of the spatial volumes that are carried by the congruence. So we saw that this is the shear tensor, which describes the deformation of the volumes without a change in the volumes, but if you draw a spherical shape that would be carried forward in time by the congruence, the shape of that spherical volume will change if the shear tensor is not zero, but its volume is going to be staying the same. The only thing that affects the volume that changes it, either increases it or decreases it, is the expansion rate. And finally, this is the rotation tensor, which is analogous to the vorticity vector in fluid mechanics that describes local rotation of fluids. Okay, so that's where we were last week, and now I want to move forward from here. So any questions or remaining issues here?
With the rotation, you can introduce the pseudo vector, right? Like there's a vorticity vector. So, but now here in four, so the spatial part, you could introduce the same thing, but you all have also now the space and time. Do those have an obvious physical significance?
No. Well, in fact, no. Understanding that this is purely transverse, we understand also those tensors must also be purely transverse. So, in a sense, there are three dimensional. Quantities that are written in four dimensions. Yeah, so in the Russian system of the functions, the time component vanishes and only pick up the spatial components. And if you do that, you can introduce the three dimensional permutation symbol and relate this to a vectorial quantity. The point is that if you want to keep using the space time rotation, the curl operator doesn't exist in space time because, you know, to define it, you would need a four-dimensional, four-index permutation symbol, and well, you can use that, but you know, you turn a two-index quantity into its dual, which is also a two-index quantity, so you haven't really gained any simplification of the math. Yep.
Since the coordinates of the relatively flat operations, for example, you might think of the expansion. Could compensate by objective coordinates, but since the theta is a covariant divergence, it's only going to be a zero point coordinate system, zero null coordinate system. So
yeah.
It is really, I mean, it's something.
Something real.
It's something real.
Yeah. 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 So and in fact, you're correct to point out that, well, I mean, there's no coordinate dependence here, because what I'm thinking of when I'm thinking of volumes and saying, well, let's pick reference Bezig and let's mark around it, you know, a three-dimensional region, you know, that are far with. So even so, I find an input by, you know, by anything positive which would be this red, say, and I look at what happens when I follow this region in the future. And the volumes are defined in an important direct way because they look in the transverse space and I can define volume elements in the transverse space in the coordinate in that way. And I don't need to specify that, but it could be done. And I talked about the way of change the fractional rate of change of those volumes and all of that can be done for the free language. And sort of no opportunity to compensate that by a coordinate change. So we're talking about real physical volume elements as opposed to elements. Yeah. In the notes, I fleshed this out a little bit. I refer about the interpretation of theta as expansion rate in terms of invariantly defined volume elements. I didn't want to go into those details here because essentially, well, the reason why I don't think it's necessary to do that, I rely a lot on the analogy between the fluid picture that we drew last time. And so the mathematics of the fluid and the mathematics of this equation and the decomposition, is in a one-to-one correspondence by virtue of the fact that all of those tensors here are transverse, so you can really think of them as purely spatial tensorial quantities. And then the analogy is, you know, immediate and direct. So. All right. All of this is done purely on a kinematical level. There's no dynamics here. If we want to talk about dynamics, we have to go beyond velocity, which is what we have here, and we have to start talking about acceleration. And if we talk about acceleration, we'll be wondering what happens. What is the rate of change of these quantities right here? So bringing dynamics into the picture means we want to know how this tensor is changing with time. And if we want to, we would want to relate the time changes of this to the time change of that, which would be the acceleration vector of, associated with the transverse deviation vector. So the dynamics would be contained in a statement about how the acceleration of geodesics behaves. And this information is contained in the rate of change of B as a tensor or the rate of change of its irreducible pieces. So I'll turn into that in a moment, but before that, I just wanted to make things perhaps a bit more concrete by looking at a very specific example and see how you compute these things. And I've talked about that example a little bit last time. I'll come back to that FRW, Robertson-Walker metric, and the confluence of time-like co-moving observers, and we'll work it all out. And that for that example, it's actually very simple. So let's talk about an example, and I'll talk about a very specific confluence of time-like 2D things. We're going to be talking about co-moving observers in an expanding universe. So I'll start by writing down metric. So it's the same metric I wrote down last time. So it's the spatially flat FRW metric. I need to restrict it to be spatially flat, but I don't see a reason to generalize the discussion to alternative spatial structures. It would just be the same. So let's use that as a metric, and the scale factor I need to determine that for this particular example. I don't care whether the space time is a solution to the Einstein field equations or not. The co-moving observers in this space time move with constant values of x, y, and z, so they only move in the time-like directions. And the vector field that's associated with this motion is the constant vector field, which only has a time component, and that time component is 1. And you can check, of course, that this vector field is normalized because GPT is minus 1. And you can check also that, well, this is a 2D vector field in space-time. Of course, we know that. I can lower the index, and if I lower the index, I'm generating a time component that has minus 1 in it. And what that tells me is that I can actually express the tangent vector field with the index down as minus the partial derivative of the time coordinate. And another way of writing this is simply to say that the tangent vector field in this case is the gradient of a time function, which happens to be equal to the time coordinate of the space-time. So that, by virtue of this equation, is a statement to the effect that my congruence is hypersurface orthogonal, because this vector is the normal vector to the surface of a constant time. And I have equality between the tangent vector field and that normal vector. So that tells me right away that dealing with vector field with the congruence, which is hypersurface orthogonal. If we didn't know that at the time, we could check this by calculating the rotation tensor, and I'll do that in just a second. And we would find zero result that would confirm the fact that we have a congruence which is hypersurface orthogonal. Here it follows very simply because our coordinates are really well adapted to congruence. Sometimes, well, to deal with space times are complicated, congruences that might be complicated, and to recognize those features requires a little bit more work. So this is a statement that we have hypersurface orthogonality. Let's make it decide right now, because it's sort of a cute little property that I didn't have time to mention last time. I'm breaking the discussion here, so this is a separate box. Suppose that I'm dealing with a vector field which is not really proportional to a gradient, but happens to be equal to a gradient of some function. The claim is that this automatically satisfies the GPT equation. Let's work it out. So this is the covariant derivative of our skewed function. Let's take that derivative And this time we get two derivatives of our scalar function. And remember one thing about this, when we have two covariant derivatives acting on the scalar function, the order can be switched. If we're doing this for a vector, the order could not be switched, we'd introduce a Riemann tensor term. But here, we don't need it. And we find that this is equal to that. All right. Well, this is equal to minus plus, I have a minus sign here for no good reason, but let's stick with it. So so this is just the alpha derivative of beta, and that's the point. If u is a gradient, I can change the order of those indices right here. And now we're almost done, because if I multiply on the right by u beta, I have this, but as we did once before, this is u beta differentiated with respect to alpha. And if I differentiate that by the product rule, I get twice the same thing, and they're both equal to that. But this is my normalized tangent vector field for my a loophole for my logic. Because I wanted to say that this is equal to zero, but I only know that this is going to be normalized or constant if I have two vector fields. So I need to get my way out of this. Right, that's my point. I know it's good that the normalization is going to be constant if we have to do the equation, but I'm trying to...
No, any monogenic vector field that can be normalized.
Yeah, but you can normalize phi. You can change that, the added can multiply phi by some constant so that this will always be...
No? No.
You have zero to by zero.
No. Okay, so no, I thought it comes here. I think the argument works only for the novel. Because if I'm dealing with the null congruence, then it's going to automatically be true that the vector is so. If phi is a null surface, its normal is going to be a null vector, and the norm of that vector is going to be zero. In which case, I don't need to think anymore. We do have the zero right-hand side. So so the argument carries through for the null case. I'll come back to it later. And I want you to erase that from memory, because I've just embarrassed myself here. And I don't think I've embarrassed myself in the book, too. And I think I spotted that before, but I forgot anyway. Sorry, so let's go back to the example. Okay, so we're back over here. And so what I want to do now, so we have the tangent vector field that I want to calculate. It's great. So, well, we just have to do it. So. If I want to calculate B, I need to calculate the covariant gradient of vector field, which requires to calculate the ordinary partial gradient and the covariant derivative, the Gestoffel term, which involves this combination of indices. Now, U alpha is constant, so the partial derivative of minus 1 is going to be 0. So I need to calculate this. And this tells me that all I have to do is to calculate the time component of all the sample circles. So that's where you go to Maypole, or you do it yourself if you wish. So you calculate the Christoff symbols, and what you find is that for the FR2 spacetime, the non-vanishing components are equal to A times A dot, unless I'm mistaken. That's right. And dot denotes just an ordinary time derivative in this context. So those are the non-vanishing Christoff symbols, which means that D will have components in the purely spatial directions, and it's going to be diagonal in the spatial directions. So B has no component along the time direction, but we knew that already. And here we have A dot, A dot, and A dot. Okay. What's H alpha? H alpha beta. H alpha beta is defined by this quantity right here, so it has no time component, because the TT component here is minus 1. Here we have 2 minus 1 multiplying each other, so we get 0. And the spatial directions, we get A squared here, but nothing from here. So H alpha beta is diagonal. It has no time direction, so no time component. And it's going to be A squared, A squared, A squared. So here we have a complete coordinate listing of all the components of B and all the components of H. And comparing the two, we have a tensorial relation that tells us that B is A dot over A times H. And that's a nice equation because it's tensorial. A dot can be interpreted as the time derivative of the scale factor, but can be also expressed in transitive tensorial form by using the lead derivative. And A can be expressed in terms of bottom evidence and things like that. But anyway, that's good enough. Well, what does that tell us? It tells us that B in this case is pure trace. There's no shear, and there's no rotation, because my B that I just calculated is proportional to H and doesn't contain any further terms. So what does it mean physically? Well, it means that B is keeping track of the expansion of the universe, and as the universe expands, my confidence of co-moving observers is not getting deformed, and that's why, you know, that's because the universe is expanding the same way in all directions, so there's no opportunity to generate a deformation. And, well, there's no rotation either. So the FRW universe doesn't have differential rotation in it, doesn't have uniform rotation in it, it has no rotation whatsoever. So that's the message. So we have expansion, but we have no shear and no rotation for this complex. And if we want to extract rotation at the expansion, we take the trace of this, which means that theta is going to be 3 times A dot over A. Well, what does that tell us? Well, the factor of 3 turns out to be important because it's the factor of 3 that tells us that we're talking about changes in volume. If we look at a volume element around one of our moving observers, dV, as the universe expands, will expand. dV is going to be something that scales according to the metric with the cube of the scale factor. The rate of change of dV is going to be proportional to 3a squared a dot. The fractional change is going to be equal, the proportionality constant is going to be removed when I take the ratio. And when I take the ratio, I get 3 a dot over B. So if it wasn't clear before, I think this simple example really just illustrates really well that the expansion scalar is a measure of fractional rate of change of cross-sectional volumes, transverse volumes, in directions that are orthogonal to the problems. So that's a simple example. In the notes, I consider another example like this, where we consider time activity physics in Schwarzschild space-time. The point is that, you know, once you're given space-time, once you have the metric, and once you have the test vector field on congruence, all the computations are algorithmic. You just go through them, compute everything, you know, perhaps using MAPLE and GR tensor to speed it up a little bit. But you can expect everything. So B is something you can calculate directly by calculating the gradient of the vector field, and then the decomposition can be accomplished, well, simply by, you know, calculating each one of these things separately. So so you get the expansion by looking at the divergence of the vector field, you get the shear by looking, you know, by computing what's on the right hand side, everything follows, everything's algorithmic, and there's really no obstacle except, you know, doing the computation. And if you can convince the computer to do it for you, then you're really in good shape. So in the next assignment, I'll assign some problems where you have to do that. And my advice as always is, you know, if you haven't done so already, do find yourself a good, you know, tensor manipulation package like GR tensor, and let the computer do the hard work. You can use your noodle more, you know, effectively if you don't have to do all of the, you know, mundane calculations. All right, so about to sit down. Okay, so let's move forward with the formal theory, and now I want to derive evolution equations for B, and you know, let dynamics reveal itself. So I'll first derive the evolution equation for B, because that's where it all starts. And then by invoking the decomposition into irreducible pieces, we'll, you know, more or less automatically obtain evolution equations for the expansion all by itself, the shear tensor all by itself, the rotation tensor all by itself. In practice, what I'll do is to derive evolution expansion for the expansion, and I'll leave the shear and the rotation as an exercise for you that I may or may not assign. It's one of the exercises in the back of chapter 2. So we'll do it in detail for theta. That's the simpler one to go through. And the other ones follow a, you know, very similar calculation, but they won't be interesting me as much as, you know, the equation we'll get for theta, which I think is one of the most important equations of general relativity, one that you can always rely on in time of need. You can write it down and guide it, and I'll try to illustrate that a little bit. Okay, so let's try to derive an equation, evolution equation for B. And what I mean is, well, let's figure out how B changes as we follow the congruence. And I'm talking here, of course, about an absolute derivative along the congruence. And what I mean is, let's compute this covariant derivative. So that's what I mean by the rate of change of B along the congruence. Well, we know what B stands for. It's the covariant derivative of the velocity fields. Now, what we're supposed to do is to take two covariant derivatives and contract the two. And here, I have to be sure that I'm doing the sequence of steps in the right order. What I'll do is to use the Riemann tensor identity to interchange the ordering of those two indices. And you'll see why I want to do that in a second. So I'll write this covariant derivative in terms of the opposite one. And then I'll compensate, I think, I never remember those signs. I'll compensate by introducing a Riemann tensor term and the correct position of the indices in this case is this one. So we have R alpha nu beta mu u nu. And the way to remember this, which I'm going to do, is to recognize that this index appears in first place in the Riemann tensor. So I'm talking about this index being reproduced here. Those two indices, the derivative indices that have been inverted, appear in the final position so I have to look it up every time. Okay, so that's the beginning. So let's isolate the first term. The first term is U alpha comma beta comma U beta U mu. And we'll be working on this. And the second term, I think I'll leave alone, except for the fact that I have freedom here of relabeling the indices, and I'll just do that. So it's going to be alpha mu beta nu U mu U mu. And I haven't changed anything. The first one, what I want to do is to transfer the beta derivative onto both terms. So I'll do that. And I think you can see why I would want to do that. So we have that, but of course we have to compensate and remove what we've just done, which is to differentiate this vector with respect to beta. So now we have that equation right here. We recognize that this is zero because we're talking about a geodesic congruent, so the acceleration vector is zero. This we recognize as b multiplied with itself, and this, of course, gives us the Riemann answer. And now we can see why we have dynamics. We have dynamics in part because we have tidal forces acting on the congruence. We have tidal forces. Gravity is different on each geodesic in the congruence. And that means that, as seen from the reference geodesic, we have tidal forces. And this term is describing this. You know, the action of tidal forces is described by the term. And this is something else that comes also into the depth equation. Okay, so that's the main equation. And what you would do then is to, if you want to derive an equation for theta all by itself, you would take the trace of that equation. And that's what we'll do in a second. If you wanted to calculate the evolution equation for sigma, well, you would take the trace, the trace-free, symmetric trace-free part of that equation. So you would symmetrize with respect to alpha and beta, and then you would remove the trace that you computed in the first step, and you would put it all together, and you generate the equation for sigma. And if you want to generate the equation for omega, well, you would take the anti-symmetric, component of that equation, and you would work it all out, and it's pretty straightforward. So I'll just do the trace piece, and as I said, I'll leave it for you to see if you can do it for sigma and omega. But the procedure is very similar. Taking the trace, though, is the simplest thing you can do, so that's why I'll do it here. So let's take the trace. So let me leave this up here, and I'll take the trace. When I take the trace B, well, I get theta. And theta differentiated in the direction of u is the proper time derivative of the expansion tensor. So the left hand side I have to take the trace is this. On the right hand side, we're taking the trace, which means that I have minus b alpha mu that multiplies b mu alpha. Taking the trace means that we have to contract those two indices. I have to be very careful at preserving the ordering here. Because B is not symmetric, so I really have to preserve the ordering of the indices here. And then when I take the trace of the Riemann term, I'm tracing over the first and third indices, that generates the Ricci tensor. So what appears on the right hand side is the time component of the Ricci tensor. Well, let's work this a little bit more. I'll use the decomposition on B to work this out fully. So let me just work that term. So we have B alpha mu B mu alpha. That involves the product of, well, everything. So here we have mu alpha, mu alpha, mu alpha. So we're going to get 9 terms, almost all of which are going to be 0. So let's work it out, and I'll do it mostly in my head, well, in your head. So we multiply the first term with the first term, we get 1/9 theta squared, and we get h that multiplies h. H that multiplies h is h, and the trace of h is 3. So when you work it out in full, you find that h times h after taking the trace is just 3. Now, that's one term. Then we multiply h times sigma. That defines the trace of sigma, which is 0. Sigma is trace 3, multiplying h times sigma gives me 0, and multiplying h by omega gives me 0 as well, because this is symmetric. This is symmetric. This will always cancel out. Okay, well, let's go ahead. Sigma times h is 0. Sigma times sigma is not 0. So we need that sigma squared first. So we have sigma alpha mu. And here I can actually switch the order of the indices because it's a symmetric tensor. So we have that. Sigma times omega is 0 because the usual reason this is symmetric, this is symmetric. All right. Okay, we're almost done. So omega times h is 0. Omega times sigma is 0. The only thing that's not 0 is omega times omega. And here, what I'll do is to switch the order of those indices, but I'll put in a minus sign. And here I'll put minus omega alpha mu, omega alpha mu. And we have our final result. The equation for theta is minus 1/3 theta squared minus sigma squared plus omega squared minus the root. And that equation is called Wright-Stiller's equation. Wright-Stiller was an Indian relativist who I think was mostly active in the 60s or 70s. I think he's famous for this. I don't think he's done anything else, but that's enough. I mean, this is an equation that, as I said, is one of the most beautiful of all general relativity and one of the most informative and one of the most useful that I know of. You know, there's the Einstein-Hill equations, that's number one, and this is number two. This is just differential geometry, right? Because I have introduced Einstein-Hill equations at this stage. If I want to get rid of the Ricci tensor and replace it by the integer momentum tensor of the Mantle distribution in the space line, I can do that by invoking the Einstein-Hill equations, and we'll do that. But at this stage, I don't need to do that. I can just leave it in this form. Well, what's the point of that equation? Why is it so useful? It's useful because of the theorem that I'll formulate next, which is known as the Fulk's theorem. So let's go into that. I'm going to introduce some assumptions. Those assumptions are a little bit restrictive. In null case, we're going to find those assumptions are not as restrictive as in this case. So the focusing theorem, full power of focusing theorem is really there. In the null case, this is really a form of exercise toward that. But it's still very useful here. And later on, we're going to actually use this equation in a way of doing cosmology in a 4-3 language. That's one of the applications of this equation that's very interesting. Okay. So let me formulate the focusing theorem. But before I do that, let me just mention that, let me just mention the physical interpretation of this equation. Theta, never forget, is the fractional rate of change of cross-sectional volumes as the fault becomes. If the congruence is expanding, the volumes are increasing and theta is positive. If the congruence is converging, it's the other way around, theta is negative. What we're interested in here is not whether the volumes are changing, increasing or decreasing. When we compute this derivative, we're actually asking whether the rate of change is accelerating or decelerating. So even if it's expanding, if theta is positive, the rate of change of theta could be negative if the rate with which the volumes are increasing is decreasing, if you follow that. If theta is converging, if the congruence is converging and theta is negative, if theta dot is negative, it means that the convergence is proceeding faster and faster. The disparation of the acceleration of the negative convergence is speeding up. I can't say that straight. But the point is that we're not just interested in whether or not the congruence is expanding or converging. We want to know whether, as it does that, whether it slows down or speeds up. And for one thing, if theta dot is negative, let's think about it. If theta dot is negative, if theta itself is positive, that means that the congruence is expanding, but it's slowing down as it does so. In the FRW example, that would be an example of an expanding universe that's slowing down in its expansion. If the congruence is converging, that's the Big Crunch picture, and theta dot is also negative, we have negative theta and negative theta dot, the congruence is contracting, but it's speeding up as it does. So that's what the left-hand side of the equation is telling us. You'll notice that the right-hand side has a bunch of negative signs. And that's why I was talking about theta not being negative, because that's the math. With this negative sign, this would always be negative. So this contributes to slowing down the rate of expansion or speeding up the rate of contraction. Same thing here. This is always positive. It's the tensor, it's the square of the tensor, and this was pure. This was truly a space-time tensor with, time entries. There would be a danger of the square of the tensor being negative, like the square of the vector being negative, if it's a time-like vector. But the fact that sigma is a purely spatial tensor, in the sense that it's always orthogonal to u, guarantees that while it's a purely spatial tensor and there's no opportunity for the square of the purely spatial tensor to ever become negative. So this felt positive, but the negative side, this is an additional contribution to theta not being negative. This is also positive for the same reason, but now we have a sign. We have not negative sign here, and the sign of this will depend on, the curvature profile of our space-time. If we want to preserve the negative sign here, we have to make sure that the UU component of the Ricci tensor or the time-time component of the Ricci tensor is positive. The focusing theorem is about two things. It's about killing this term because it has an embarrassing positive sign. We don't want it. We'll get rid of it. And it's about making sure that the Ricci tensor is always positive in its time-time component. Those are the conditions of the focusing theorem. If we have that, we have the right-hand side being purely negative, and that guarantees that theta dot will be negative. And that's the statement that if the congruence is expanding, it's going to slow down in its expansion, or if it's contracting, it's going to speed up in its contraction. I'll write this all down in a minute. But what does it really mean? Well, the geodesics are flying apart. So let's say we have congruence that's expanding. The geodesics are expanding, flying apart. Think of the moving observers in the expanding universe. Well, if gravity does its thing, and if gravity is an attractive force, you would expect the moving observers to all be gravitationally attracted to one another, and you would expect that the sensible universe might be expanding, but it could slow down its expansion. Only a sensible universe, sensible universes would behave like that. Only, strange, crazy, stupid universes would actually speed up as they expect. So sensible universes would have gravity that's attractive with that hit. And that's a guarantee that if gravity is attractive, that even though the universe is expanding and the constants are expanding, that it actually slows down as it does. The focusing theorem will produce that statement, will guarantee that, only if you can put the right condition on the Ricci test, and only if you can kill that term. You know, conversely, if you have contracted couplets, that's the big crunch picture, or, you know, observer spot picture of black hole. If the conference is contracted, the negative sign for right side guarantees that, well, it will continue to do that, but it will speed up as it does it. Well, if it's contracted and gravity is attractive, it will speed up the process. And if you're pointing toward black hole, it will speed up the process until all observers speed together. And that's the black hole singularity. So I think now you can see that there's a lot of information contained here. And I've even, you know, talked about metrics, I've talked about the Einstein field equations very much. It's all information that's extractable from this equation by putting in conditions here and formulating a focusing theorem. So I'll go through that and write down a few more things, but I'll go, you know, that's the power of that equation. And we're only beginning. I mean, there's more to it than that. You have a question? Right.
Yeah. It doesn't really mean anything to say perhaps an attractive force. So what you said to be an unreasonable universe is nonetheless be perfectly well defined.
Yes. So I was making a leap. I was assuming that fluid talked about here is a fluid that's responsible for creating curvature. And to get back to that, this consistency in that condition. But you're sort of right, this is not an aspect, you know, it's not special. It's an added feature that I put into the science. But you're sort of right, so if you're talking about components of test particles, then, you know, it just follows what the universe is telling them to do when there's no self gravity, and therefore the expansion is going to go away. Okay, so let's just formulate the focusing theorem a little bit more formally. So we have assumptions for premises and assumptions. The first one is that we're going to be dealing with congruence that's hypersurface orthogonal. And that kills off the only good thing. Yes, we're losing generality. Let's live with that. Condition number two, we're going to impose a condition on the Ricci tensor. That the time-time component of the Ricci tensor must be positive, or at least not negative. When I look at the equation this way, and I think purely in terms of Ricci tensor, this seems to be just the geometric condition on the kind of space-time that I would consider. If I throw in the Einstein field equations, I'm making a statement about the energy momentum tensor of the matter distribution. And then it becomes a physical requirement on the matter that lives in my space-time. So formulated in terms of T mu nu, we're dealing with this condition. And when you write it in that form, so here I'm using the Einstein field equations to write this in terms of that. And if you write it like that, it's called the strong energy condition. And I don't want to spend too much time talking about the energy conditions, but we can sort of roughly what this equation is trying to tell us. First of all, we have the time-time component of the energy momentum tensor in the equation. For the observer moving from this velocity vector, the time-time component of T mu nu is the energy density of the matter distribution. And if you think of all, you know, the classical matter that exists out there that can be, you know, a candidate for matter that you find in your spacetime, it's sort of possible that energy density should be positive, and therefore it seems like fairly, you know, to require that this component all by itself be positive seems to be pretty innocuous and seems to be plausible, and you can think that you're losing all that much by keeping this condition, imposing that condition. Where it gets a little clumsy is where you have to modify the statement by determining the volume of trace of T mu nu, which for fluid involves a combination of rho and pressure. So it's a combination of energy density and pressure. So this term is actually positive because G multiplying U and U gives us minus one. So the statement in this form is really that the energy density as measured by the observer moving at speed U plus half of T, the trace of the energy momentum tensor, it's the sum must be positive. And there it gets a little bit stronger than you would like because, it's called strong energy condition because you've made, you know, it would be physically very possible to say this term by itself to be positive. When you add the trace and you think about the possibility of the trace being negative for a certain form of matter, I have, I have an example in mind. Anyway, this by itself, it's impossible to find classical matter models, fluid models, or electromagnetic fields or anything like that that would have negative energy density. It's possible to find classical matter fields such that this condition is violated. So the strong energy condition is a little bit stronger than what you would like to impose. And in fact, it's possible to find purely classical matter fields that violate this. An example, I think, is a massive scalar field. If you have massive scalar field as your candidate for fundamental matter in the universe, the massive scalar field will, in fact, have T mu nu that violates this, this condition. So it's a little bit strong. And for that reason, the time, the Fokker theorem in the time-like case is not really optimal. But the Fokker theorem really becomes really powerful and optimal in null case because in null case, we will have to deal with that. Because null case, of course, this would be zero. And the only condition we'll have to propose is the condition that the measured, observed energy density be positive. Now, in recent history, people have talked about quantum field theory in curved space-time and have, you know, become aware of the Casimir effect, for example, between two conducting plates, where it's in fact possible using quantum field theory, quantum mechanics and more, you know, more generality to actually concoct situations where even energy density can be negative. So it's possible to borrow energy from the vacuum and build a state, quantum state that has negative energy density in small localized regions. So for those reasons, the energy conditions turn out to be a little bit of an embarrassment and a little bit of a, you know, stronger condition that you'd like to impose on things. But, you know, in order to prove the focusing theorem, we have to impose these things. I'll say a few more things about negative energy densities in a moment, because it turns out that there's an interesting application to the focusing theorem to wormholes. And I'll just a few things about that a little bit later. Another example where you violate the strong energy condition is with vacuum energy, you know, that gives you the same space time. So if you're commuting, so for example, if you have vacuum energy or dark energy in your space time, and you say that T mu nu associated with that is the cost constant times the metric, then, well, we can work it out. We find that this term is going to be so the left side of the strong energy condition would tell us that minus lambda plus a half the trace is 4 lambda, so I get 3 lambda.
Plus lambda minus 1/2 lambda minus 3 lambdas.
What?
Because G is minus 1 for the advanced time, and,
right.
then 1 for the other one. So you can get lambda. You can get minus lambda plus 3.
Oh, the first
one.
Oh, you're right. It's, yeah. So I'm throwing the term from the left-hand side of the equation to the right-hand side. So it appears with the plus sign on the left-hand side. It will appear with the minus sign on the thing on the right-hand side. So lambda is defined that way, which means that the term here is minus plus minus. So yeah. So the requirement would be that minus 3 lambda ought to be positive. And if we're talking about positive constant, we're violating these continuity conditions. If we're talking about just this term, we're still okay. This being positive is called weak energy condition. And that's a sensible condition for classical forms of matter. We would have that in the case of vacuum energy, the strong energy condition we don't have. Okay, so let's not worry too much about all of this for the formation of the focusing theorem in this context. In the time-like context, I need to impose the strong energy condition. Let's be aware that it's possible to violate that, and while the possibility of constant vacuum energy type matter is probably the most relevant example of possible of a violation of the strong energy condition. Nevertheless, I need it for the formation of the theorem, and essentially the theorem says this. So if we have that statement, if we have those conditions, then the Reitz-Alfuri equation guarantees that the rate of change of the expansion will be negative, or it's not positive. So if theta is positive, that means that congruence is expanding. But it's shown that if the expansion is negative, the congruence is contracting, and the rate which does that, it's speeding up. So basically, all of that is saying that, well, it's a very analogous, direct analogous, if I make that same leap that I made before, if I'm throwing the chalk up, it's going to go up, but it's going to be slowing down. But if I throw it down, it's going to go down, but it's going to be speeding up. That's exactly what the expansion is doing. So if the congruence is expanding, it's going to keep on expanding, but slow it down. It's going to be slowing down the process. If it's already contracting, then it will speed up and continue to contract. And in fact, if you follow the equations, and I give you a little bit more details in the notes about this, what you find is that, well, by working out how things behave, you can put a bound on how theta behaves as a function of time. And in fact, you can deduce from this equation that theta will, so if congruence is initially contracting, in this case over here, theta will be driven to minus infinity in a finite time. That's the sort of a strong version of the focusing theorem that says that if the initial value of theta is negative, the evolution due to Reitz-Alfuri equation will guarantee that theta will be driven to negative, to larger negative values, and things continue to speed up until in fact theta goes to minus infinity. And that occurs with a finite amount of property. So in this case, theta will approach minus infinity in a finite proper time tau. What does that mean physically? Well, theta is the fractional rate of change of volumes. Volumes are getting smaller. And if theta becomes minus infinity, that means that the volumes are actually shrinking to zero. And what that means is that the congruence is actually breaking down what the requirement to define the congruence was always that you had to have one 2D success through each space-time event, space-time point. If volumes are shrinking down, that means that GPs are starting to cross. So the picture is where you have one 2D thing that goes like this, you have another one that goes like that, and they're contracting. That's the meaning of contracting congruence. They're all approaching one another, and in time, they'll start to meet. They don't have to meet all at the same point, but they'll start to meet. And at that point, the cross-sectional volume goes to zero, and of course, that means that theta will be driven to minus infinity. When that happens for, you know, light rays, you call that a focal point, or you call that a cost, the cost of the congruence. So this is the cost of the congruence. The cost is the singularity of the congruence where this kinematical description fails because, you know, we have violated the essential definition of congruence, which is to say that, you know, through each point there should be only one duty passing through. Here we have more than one, and of course that's the place where our description is failing. Our physical quantities are, you know, the singularities, and physically that means that they're producing caustics or focal points. And caustics can be, you know, at the point, that's the focal point, but caustics can also be on surfaces. And people who study caustics in ray optics, you know, have mapped out all the possible shapes of caustics, and it's a rather nice, you know, set of work that's been done on that. You have beautiful patterns, and those can be seen, you know, whenever you look at, at light interacting with media, you have formation of caustics like that. So there's a pretty good theory of caustic formations. And in fact, you know, the theory that applies to light rays is very much similar to the theory we've just developed here. It's, you know, more of the same mathematics. All right. So, the central message here really is that while this is an equation that tells us that gravity, if you have the right conditions on congruence and the right condition on mass distribution, gravity tends to be attractive in the sense that if the congruence is expanding, it will slow down. If the congruence is contracting, it will speed up. And if it's contracting like this, it will speed up to up the formation of caustic like this. In the context of black holes, you can do more theorems and you can form things and in fact show that formation of a caustic in black interior, in fact, is the formation of the central singularity. So, you know, one way of thinking about the singularity theorem is simply to say that, well, if you're inside the event horizon, or, you know, more technically speaking, inside the apparent horizon of black hole, you have congruences of light rays of time-like geodesics that is contracted because it's falling inward inside the black hole. And once you have that, well, you have continued contraction due to the Rayleigh-Lewis equation. And you add a few other elements to that, but because you have guaranteed caustic formation, that tells you that you have automatic, in the black hole context, it tells you that you have automatic singularity formation. So once you're inside the black hole, once you have established the existence of trapped surfaces, the further evolution of the light rates guarantee that you will develop singularity. And that is, you know, very simply put, you know, the Hawking-Pennington singularity theorem for black holes. So that is involved in a very essential way to the statement and proof of the singularity theorem. Let's mention a couple of other contexts where this equation can be really, really informative. People, I'll mention three examples. Let's talk about the Phoenix campus. How do you spell Phoenix? There's an O and there's an E somewhere. Is it? Oh. what's a Phoenix universe? Well, the idea is that, you know, the universe expanded, it collapsed after a while, and it's going to collapse to a big crunch, and then it's going to re-expand again. You have those infinite successions of universes. So I guess at that conference would be, well, it could be expanding phase, here it could be collapsing phase, and then that's just, and it goes out again, so the universe would look like, you know, something like that. So we have an expanding phase, we have a contraction phase, and then we have that, and then we have re-expansion phase. Well, suppose that, you know, this universe is supposed to satisfy all the requirements of the focusing theory, especially the matter condition. The condition of the rotation is okay, because we can assume that the co-moving observers are, you know, are to be orthogonal to surfaces of constant time. So this is not a big problem, but we'll have to pay attention to that part. Well, if we have a progress that's first expanding and then retracting, that's fine. That's all predicted by each other's equation. You know, it slows down and eventually it stops, and it starts contracting. So the transition from expansion to contraction certainly does not, you know, raise flag as far as the rate of energy equation is concerned. But once it starts contracting, if we want to produce a balance and a re-expansion, we have to have progress that will collapse on itself, will contract, and then avoid the formation of constants, bounce out and re-expand again. So we're going to be dealing here with a situation where theta is negative and transition to theta being positive, and presumably there is no singularity in between. We have smooth, you know, phase of contraction that follows, that will, you know, lead to another smooth phase of expansion. That, I think, is the idea of the Phoenix universe. Well, theta being negative, so in this phase we have theta dot. So at bounds, if we want to turn theta being negative to theta being positive, we need to have a regime where theta dot changes sign. Is that possible? Well, the focusing theorem says not. The focusing theorem says theta dot is always going to be negative. So what do you do? How do you produce a Phoenix universe? Any ideas? Right.
So one thing that you have to do
is to make sure that you violate the energy conditions right here. Because it's only if you do that, if you momentarily, you know, make gravity repulsive, that you can turn a contraction to an expansion. So people who have entertained those kinds of models before, you know, usually they think of this as being a sort of quantum gravity regime where everything goes. And if everything goes, well, negative energy density goes, and therefore you can, you know, you can do something like that. But it's good to think about what actually needs to happen for that to happen, and you need a massive gross violation of the energy conditions to turn contract the universe into an expanding universe. So there were some questions you have, buddy?
Sort of horizon or something where you have something like when you go into the black hole, and then your time and your spatial work can kind of have a switch, and then you might be able to, because then this theta, you would have to sort of switch, and this theta would not have the same meaning anymore.
Okay, there are situations that arise inside black holes, and we'll come to that later on in the course. What you say about the coordinates switching their roles is correct. So, you know, as you go inside the Schwarzschild black hole, R no longer is a spatial variable, it becomes a time-like variable. T is no longer a time-like variable, it becomes a spatial variable. Tau, proper time, is always defined as time. And it's always defined, you know, along the motion of a physical observer. So the meaning of theta, in fact, does change even as you go inside the black hole. So, so there's still ramifications for the interior of black holes, but it's not contained in changing the interpretation of theta dot. You had a
question? Okay, so I think the picture here is that if you want to have a smooth, singular free transition
between the contracting universe and an expanding universe, you want to stay away from constants. You don't want if all the word lines were to pile up on top of each other, if you had a focal point, that would correspond to matter densities going to infinity and all of that stuff. And, you know, the Phoenix universe is supposed to prevent that from happening. You know, that was designed so that you would avoid the disaster of the final singularity of your theory, and you would magically turn it around in this kind of way.
Violate energy conditions in a specific region of space time involved in the past, wouldn't that mean that the non-gravitational forces would be inhomogeneous in time and therefore violate energy momentum conservation?
Well, there's, I don't think there's any reason for them to be homogeneous in time because, you know, the universe is evolving in time in this case. So your question is whether you can actually have a matter distribution that suddenly decides to violate an energy condition while preserving energy momentum conservation. And I think it's possible because you can think of you know, different matter fields in an expanding universe will scale, the energy density of matter field, depending on the nature of the field, will scale differently with a scale factor. For example, dust scales as, the density of dust scales as 1 over a cubed, like volume, but radiation scales as 1 over 8 to the fourth. So you can have separately conserved exotic matter field that play almost no role in the universe until A becomes small enough, so we can scale like A to the 19th, you know, something like that. So it's completely irrelevant for the dynamics of the universe when it's large, but when it becomes small, it starts to dominate, and it happens to violate the energy conditions always, but you never notice until it becomes dominant. So I think it's possible to have all of that. Another example along those lines is, you know, there are people who try to also avoid the final disaster of singularity inside the black hole by making the black hole bounce and branch off to the universe. Let's see, I'm not sure how to draw this. Yeah, I don't know what I want to draw here. I would like to draw a Penrose diagram. Can you handle the Penrose diagram? Well, let's do it. Hey. So, okay, let's draw a crustal diagram. See, that's almost the same thing. So, when you have collapsed to a black hole, the usual story is that, well, you have contracting congruence of observers that fall toward the black hole, and they have to keep on contracting, and, and here they actually encounter the singularity. So that's an example of a contracting universe or a contracting congruence that terminates into the singularity. Now, suppose that you really don't like the singularity. You say that the singularity should not be part of the actual physical situation, and you want to produce a universe that, so you want to turn the interior of the black hole into some large universe in which you can, you know, you can access if you fall into a black hole. Well, if you can access this large universe, that means that the congruence will have to turn around and bounce the same way that it did in the Phoenix universe. Think like that. It's not a very good background, but you see the picture. So you have this congruence that's contracting, and if it were to obey the Wright-Schroeder equation and also the singularity theorems, it would continue to contract until it encounters the singularity. But now you want to prevent that from happening, and you want to let the congruence bounce out and you know, get into a big universe or something that, you know, be accessible by, you know, a large universe can be accessible by going into the black hole. And again, you have to, you know, to make that happen, like in the universe, you have to produce a bounce of the congruence, and that has to imply the existence of, you know, massive amounts of negative energy matter that would actually turn gravity repulsive in that area of the black hole and allow, you know, disallow the formation of the singularity. So people do that, and people make, you know, matter fields, you know, ad hoc, and say that, well, because I don't like singularities, I can postulate that matter will behave like this as it approaches singularity, and you prevent singularity from happening, and then you look at what happens next, and you know, and you produce the bridge to, you know, to a distant universe, or you know, a baby universe, or something like that, and have a nice singularity from space time. Invariably, that requires you know, the violation of energy conditions. Now, it should start to dawn on you that, you know, when you want to construct something like this, or construct you know, the details of the Phoenix universe, you would have to write down the metric. You would have to, you know, check whether the so you would compute. You know, you would write down the metric that contains all the properties you want your Phoenix universe to have, or your singularity free black hole to have, and then you would check whether or not the Einstein answer corresponding to that metric has the right science and has the right, you know, physical interpretation in terms of mass distribution. And all of that requires a lot of detailed work. What I want you to really go home with, at least until this afternoon, is that we don't need to do a lot of detailed work once we know about this, because the focusing theorem and drawing diagrams and figuring out what the congruence of observers is supposed to do in that space-time tells us immediately, without calculation, that there has to be a distribution of negative energy matter to make that happen. So it's very powerful. I mean, you can, once you know this, you don't need to calculate things. You can see that, you know, you're referring a paper and you see that, you know, your author is trying to do something which cannot be done. You can say, well, you know, it cannot be done, and why, and you have to revise the paper. Anyway, there are lots of examples like that. I'll just mention another one very quickly, and that's the wormhole idea. In the 80s, it became, you know, a part of industry and relativity to construct wormhole spacetimes and to discuss what can happen if you have wormholes. And the idea is always something like this. You have, you know, I'm drawing two sheets here that represent distant portions of the universe. They're really part of the same universe, and they're connected, you know, way over there. But what you want to do is to find a shortcut that will take you from here to here without having to go all the way around to the other side of the universe. And the idea was to say, okay, let's construct a wormhole in between those two sheets, and you would be able to go through the wormhole and travel quickly to a distant part of the universe. So it could be a distant part of the universe, or it could be disjoint universes. I don't really care here. It became a cottage industry when the Caltech group started to become involved. I mean, Kip Thorne had a whole research program based on traversable wormholes for a while. And the story is that, well, we got a phone call from Carl Sagan at some point. Sagan was right in contact, and he needed a mechanism by which, you know, the woman astronomer would travel to a distant galaxy and, you know, get to talk to the people over there and come back and so on. And he thought, you know, initially, Sagan thought, okay, I'll use a black hole for that. And so my character will go down the black hole, will go outside to the other universe, and somehow will come back. You know, I can see that, you know, relativity all that well. But he knew enough to call Kip Thorne, and Kip said, you know, he asked Kip this possible scenario, and he said, no. There are lots of, you know, lots of reasons why this is a really bad idea. But if you think about it, then, you know, wormholes have sort of been around for a while. The idea of having traversable wormholes was something that was new in the 80s, and, you know, Kip did a lot of work with that, and then discovered that these things can be turned into time machines. And, you know, it became a really runaway story. But anyway, so the idea was to construct a wormhole, and then, you know, initially, Kip and his students wrote down detailed metrics and checked out, you know, what kind of matter fields you would need to put in place to build a wormhole like this. And they discovered that in order to maintain the black hole open and make it traversable in the two different ways, you had to put in a lot of negative energy matter down here. You had to have, you know, massive amounts of exotic matter, matter with negative energy density, to make this, you know, this scenario possible. Well, if Kip was smart, I think I can say that. Yeah. If Kip had been smart, he would have recognized that this was the case immediately without doing any calculations, because what do we have here? Imagine that you go down the wormhole this way, you have to come out like that. If you go down the wormhole this way, you'll come out like that. We have converging confluence of observers all making their way down the wormhole. They're contracted here, but they're expanding on the other side. Again, we've changed the sign of theta dot by going down the wormhole. Changing the sign of theta dot is forbidden unless by the energy conditions. And just drawing the diagram, knowing about Fuchs' theorem tells you that, and you go to the calculations. If you want to know how much, you know, energy you need to assemble, negative energy you need to assemble to make, you know, a large wormhole, if you want to know where is the energy, negative energy supposed to be localized, all of those detailed questions, you have to do the hard work, you have to, you know, do the details, but, you know, to conclude on the existence of exotic matter to build a wormhole, something that follows immediately from the Fuchs' theorem. So that's why I'm so impressed by that equation. That's why I think it's, you know, it's number two in the list of most powerful equations of general relativity, right after the Einstein field equations, because it gives you access to a lot of intuition. And it's very good to have intuition, and it's very good to rely on intuition, and it saves you from, you know, doing a lot of detailed calculations when you don't have to. Have a question?
Energy negative pressure.
Okay, so in the context of this theorem, I'm really talking about this negative. But in order to repeat the story using the null, so this afternoon we'll talk about null conferences. We'll talk about Fuchs' theorem for null physics, which can be associated with light waves. So if I'm thinking of light waves going down the wormhole and re-merging on this side, then it's really negative energy density that we need to produce a violation of the Fuchs' theorem. The Fuchs' theorem in the null case will involve only that. And, you know, that is also a bit more, but it's really the negative energy, this would be negative energy density that we need to have in order to produce. Without doing calculations. But then, if you want to ask a more detailed question, how much of it do you need, then you have to look at this equation in a bit more detail. But think about this. You know, your congruence is contracting, which means that, it can shrink that pretty fast. The fraction rate of polygons is shrinking pretty fast, which means that not only is this negative, it's probably pretty large. I don't know about this, but let's assume that they're of the same order of magnitude and also pretty sizable. In order to turn behavior around, you need to make this at least as large as those other terms to compensate behavior. So that means that depending on how fast the congruence was contracted to begin with, if you want to have very sudden bounce, you're going to need a really large amount of negative energy density. If you can do this early, you know, early enough, then you need less, but you need in a large region. So, you know, there's some various trade-offs and things like that. And I think you know, depending on the context, you need to do the detailed work of figuring out exactly what you need. And, you know, in fact, there's, you know, the Calvin group did that. And in the early 80s, they actually mapped out, you know, for simple solutions, they actually mapped out exactly how much energy you would need localized where, and, you know, the general state of something like this. If you wanted to produce a traversable wormhole, there's at least 1 meter across that you would fit into it. And if on top of that you want to be sure that the wormhole can exert tidal forces on you that would kill you, you needed to accumulate, I think, something like Jupiter mass worth of negative energy density in the throat of the wormhole, which is, you know, meters across. That's what we've done. John. Okay, so again, that's an assumption that is a little bit strong, and in a time like case, you'd like to live without it.
And in the sunlight case, this is really a statement about becoming a study about synthesis. I mean, the shear free congruence is really a very restricted set of all possible congruences.
So if the only focusing theorem we had for this postal was this one, there would be a lot of generality being lost in the statements. Here, I can save myself by saying that everything's strictly symmetric, congruence will be strictly symmetric, therefore the shear would be zero, things like that. In the time-like case, in the null case, if I think of null geodesics as arising from geometric optics, you know, in the limit of applying Maxwell's equations and doing geometric optics, if I think of null geodesics as physical light case, then the hypersurface finality condition comes for free because my surfaces are surfaces of constant phase in the solution of Maxwell's equations. So so in that context, you know, with the added physics, I have that condition for free, and therefore no big loss of generality. Oh, sorry, rotation free. Oh no, so yeah, that's right. So I don't need to. Yeah, sorry. I don't need to say anything about this, but I need to kill that term. So I did the rotation free condition. That's the one that comes free. In time like case, the rotation free congruence, again, is a restriction on what the congruence is able to do. And in fact, if you have rotation, you have some momentum vectors that can, in fact, prevent the collapse to a central focal point. So.
Yeah, I mean, the first place that would be the most obvious example. The curve space network, you have the rotation of the black hole that uses an overall rotation to direct the inertial frames around it. So, yeah. Well, we've gone on long enough, so let's have lunch and we'll
meet again for. And we'll do the null case for, I think now we're ready to go there.
Can you get a word that has no skin to it? It can come to the other end. Yeah, like why did the geodesics have to go in the
That was my simple example. So it's possible that you could make the wormhole more contrived than adding the momentum and things like that, but you would not be able to change the condition. I mean, you would not be able to. So here we have extra restrictions that are not essential that will be removed when we go to the null case. And there, I think you have really a foolproof case against wormholes unless you violate the energy conditions. I don't think you can debate that. But the proof is more complicated than what I described here.